took me to a restaurant. I couldn't find no fork for the longest time till I saw him unroll the dark red towel he had on his side of the table. He caught me gawking and told me the towel was a napkin, which I thought was crazy, 'cause who gonna wash 'em all? Me and Miss Debbie started talking a little more, too. I didn't burn off when I saw her no more, and when she asked me how I was doing, I'd say fine. She was always real nice to me, asked me about my life and what was I going to do that day, and did I need her to bring me anything. I'd see her down at the lot, and I'd help out her and Sister Betty and Miss Debbie's friend, Miss Mary Ellen. I met Sister Betty before I met Miss Debbie. She ain't no nun or nothing like that. We call her Sister 'cause she's a real spiritual woman. I don't know how old Sister Betty was when I met her, but right this minute, she got a crown, a hair just as white as a cloud on a summer day, and twinkling eyes as blue as the sky them clouds go sailing in. When she's talking to you, she'll lay a hand on your arm like she knowed you all your life, like maybe you was her own child. And even if she keeps her hand there a while, it don't bother you none. You just feel happy God saw fit to drop a lady like that into this world. Sister Betty lives at the mission, but it ain't 'cause she don't have nowhere else to go. A long time back, she lived in a regular neighborhood, but after her husband died, Sister Betty felt the Lord tugging on her heart, telling her to spend the rest of her life serving the homeless. She sold her home and everything she had except for a little bitty Toyota truck. And she asked the folks at the Union Gospel Mission, could she set up housekeeping down there? It didn't take long for most of the homeless folk in Fort Worth know Sister Betty. She'd go to restaurants to ask them for their leftovers, and stores to ask them for socks and blankets and toothpaste and such. Then she'd haul her old bones up and down the nastiest streets, offering help to men so mean they'd as soon tear your head off as look at you. That didn't scare Sister Betty none, 'cause she believed God's angels camped all around her and wasn't going to let nothing bad happen to her. And if it did, she said that would be God's will. She never carried no purse with her, just whatever she had to give out that day and her Bible. After a while, it got so it didn't matter what Sister Betty believed about God's angels. Even the meanest man on the street wouldn't dare lay hands on her, 'cause he'd get beat down if he did. To this day, that woman could walk naked on the railroad in Hobo Jungle at midnight and be safe as if she was tucked in her own bed. After I'd been at the mission a while, I started helping Sister Betty with some things. We never did have no conversation, but if she needed something, she knew she could ask me and I'd do it. Like I helped her keep her little truck running, change the oil and fan belt, that kind of thing. I also started helping her out at the lot, a place street folks called Under the Tree. It's over on Annie Street, in one of the worst neighborhoods in the city, spilling over with crackheads and criminals and ragged, empty-eyed folks living so low, they're surprised every time they open their eyes and find out they done lived through another day. Don't get me wrong, wasn't like I was clean and sober all the time, neither. Just 'cause me and Mr. Ron was friends don't mean I turned into no overnight saint. We might have been going out to a fancy place in the daytime, but at night I still go out to the Hobo Jungle and pass around the Jim Beam with the fellas. I tried not to drink too much on Tuesday nights, though, because I like to help Sister Betty out the next day. Every Wednesday, she fed 200 or 250 folks at the lot, and it was always some kind of miracle, like the loaves and fishes story in the Bible. Nobody really knows where all the food come from, but every week, you can smell it 2 blocks away. Big steaming pots of beef stew full of carrots and peas and potatoes. Baskets of fried chicken, fresh cooked pintos, and kettles of chili. All of it's home cooked. Seemed like folks just showed up with it out of nowhere. One day, somewhere along the way, Sister Betty found out I could sing, and she asked me would I come down and sing at the lot. First, I was a little worried about it, but when Sister Betty asks you to help out, ain't too much you can do but help out.
Chapter 26. In Sister Betty, Deborah sensed someone who would lead her into a new spiritual dimension, a level of service more fearless, more sacrificial than what she could perform inside the walls of the mission. She wanted to share the experience with her best friend, Mary Ellen Davenport, whom Deborah called a prayer warrior, which is to say, she'd stop and offer to pray with anyone about anything for as long as they would let her. Plucky is a silly-sounding word, but Webster's defines it as spirited and brave. It should have included a picture of Mary Ellen. A registered nurse, she and her husband, Alan, a physician, became our friends in 1980 when we threw a July 4 pool party at the Williamsburg-style home we'd moved into in Fort Worth 2 years earlier. We'd invited our friends, the Hawkins, who asked if they could bring their friends, the Davenports. Alan and Mary Ellen had recently moved back to Fort Worth from Galveston, where Alan had completed his medical residency. We didn't know them personally, but Deborah knew of them. She had heard that Mary Ellen had a difficult pregnancy with triplets, and she had been praying for her by name. But when the Davenports pulled up to our address on the day of the party, and Mary Ellen spotted our sweeping porch, tall white columns, and a three-car garage that looked bigger than their whole house, she threw a fit. "I'm not going in there," she told Alan. "Why not?" he asked. "Why not? My gosh, just look at their house. They're millionaires. What could we possibly have in common with them?" So the Davenports sat in the car with the air conditioning blasting and debated whether to stay. Soon the triplets, by then 15 months old, and J-Mac, their 3-year-old, were wailing. Decked out in swimsuits and floaties, their dials were tuned to swim, and they didn't like the sound of the conversation up front. In the end, Mary Ellen lost the battle, and I remember them walking into our backyard for the first time. Ellen grinning nervously and the smile pasted on Mary Ellen's face as fake as a Rembrandt painted in Chihuahua, but Deborah rescued the afternoon. "I'm so glad to finally meet you," she said, greeting Mary Ellen with a warm smile. "I've been praying for you and your family for months." Then Deborah, the millionaire's wife, offered to babysit the triplets so that the Davenports could get organized in their new home. At that, Mary Ellen threw down her weapons. Gracefully, she accepted the offer, launching a close family friendship that would last decades. From Mary Ellen, Deborah learned boldness. Deborah had never been bold, just persistent. Mary Ellen was bold and persistent. So when Deborah invited her friend to join her in volunteering at the mission, Denver's misery was doubled, he later said, since that meant two white ladies were pestering him instead of just one. At Sister Betty's urging, Deborah and Mary Ellen began teaching and singing a day each week at the mission's women's and children's chapel service. But it was Sister Betty's service at the lot that drew Deborah like a magnet. The lot itself is a lush little refuge dotted with red crepe myrtles, rough-hewn benches, and a cross made of railroad ties topped with a crown of thorns, someone fashioned from barbed wire. The area surrounding the lot, however, is a model for urban decay. Rusted chain link, buildings boarded up and condemned, adjoining lots clotted with Johnson grass that hid bodies that barely oozed life. Next door to the lot, Sister Betty's free lunch customers stumble out of Lois's lounge, a dark little den where they blot out their waking lives by drinking cheap liquor purchased with panhandled funds. I'm not judging them. It's just a simple fact that in America, drugs and booze cost money. But food is free to anyone willing to snooze through a gospel message. Scores of them do, dragging themselves to the lot each week, some riding rusting wheelchairs pushed by others who can barely stand, others carried on the backs of men more sober than themselves. Often, following an afternoon there, Deborah would return home in tears, her heart broken by encounters with drug addicts and alcoholics, people busy paying a very high price for very low living. Before we ever connected with him, we sometimes glimpsed Denver there, standing across the street, stock still and trying to blend in with the telephone pole. I asked Sister Betty about him. What specifically is his problem? Denver? She replied in that soft way of hers, smiling. Oh, he's very helpful. Keeps my little truck running, and he can sing beautifully. From time to time, she said she could coax him into doing so at the lot, or at the chapel service, where she taught on Thursdays. With Denver, you must ask him only at the moment you want him, because with any warning, he'll slip away and disappear. Though we'd become friends, Denver hadn't entirely abandoned his vanishing act. Now he felt guilty facing people on the street, many of whom he had at one time or another threatened to kill. They feared the old Denver. But the one that was emerging scared even him. So he would often disappear when asked to do Christian things, like sing for Sister Betty. Deborah and I served as constant reminders to him that change was underway, change he could have lived just fine without. Meanwhile, following hard after what she felt was her call to serve, Deborah blossomed. In 29 years of marriage, I'd never seen her happier. I can also attest that as a couple, we had never been more deeply in love. The peace forged in counseling in the early years at Rocky Top had mellowed into an upbeat contentment. We might have gotten there a lot faster if I'd been willing to recognize the truth of an old saying, "If Mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy." But we got there. And from the summit of our relationship, Deborah exported a fresh and contagious joy to the lot. There, under the giant and ancient elm that shaded the benches, she always found some pearls hidden below the amber sea of crushed beer bottles and syringes. The pearl she found one day glistened in the smile of a grizzled street veteran who lived under a railroad trestle in a cardboard box shaped like a casket. This man ate from garbage cans, an unpleasant truth you knew automatically if you had a nose. His beard was matted with dry vomit and the remnants of his last few meals, and he reeked so strongly of booze that it seemed he might explode if someone got too close and struck a match. Here was a man whose life seemed disposable. Yet he found a reason to smile. Drawn to him, Deborah offered him a plate of home-cooked food and a prayer. Then, truly puzzled, she asked him, Why are you so happy?
I woke up, he replied, eyes twinkling in his haggard face, and that's reason enough to be happy.
Deborah rushed home to tell me what he'd said, as though she'd been given a treasure that needed to be deposited immediately in my memory bank. From that day on, three words, "We woke up," were the first to come out of our mouths.
A tiny prayer of thanksgiving for something we'd always taken for granted, but that a derelict had had the wisdom to see as a blessing fundamental to all others. We greeted each other that way every morning, never suspecting that each morning would soon be a precious gift we could count on one hand.
Chapter 27. It wasn't long before Miss Debbie and Miss Mary Ellen started asking me what I sing in their chapel service. I would, if they were smart enough to catch me. I'd sing some spirituals I brung with me in my heart from the plantation. Other times, I'd sing some songs I made up on my own. Like I said, I know plenty of scripture. It didn't take long, though, before Miss Debbie started getting bossy again. She got a burr under her saddle about something she called a retreat. Said her and a bunch of her Christian friends was going up to the woods to hear from the Lord. "I've been praying about it, Denver," she'd say whenever she seen me. "And I believe God's telling me that you should go with us." I asked some of the fellows around the mission if they knowed what a retreat was, and not a one of them had any idea. Except Mr. Scheistler. He said a retreat was some religious thing where you go off someplace lonesome and talk and pray and cry all weekend. I know for sure I didn't want nothing to do with that. But Miss Debbie wouldn't let up. I just shined her on, though, 'cause wasn't no way in the world I was fixing to drive up in no woods with no carload of white women. Well, then I guess she put Mr. Ron on the case. One day at Starbucks, he started in talking about retreat this and retreat that, said it wasn't going to be just women. Men was going to be there, too. "Think about all the nice folks you'll meet," he said, "and all that free food." "Not from Jump Street," I said. "I ain't going. I ain't going nowhere to no retreat to meet nobody. And I especially ain't going to no retreat with no white lady that's somebody else's wife." Just so we'd be clear on the whole thing, I eyeballed him like he was crazy. I ain't real sure what he told Miss Debbie after that, but the very next time I went through the serving line, she blowed out from behind that counter like a streak of lightning. And here come that skinny finger in my face again. "Denver, you are going with me to the retreat, and I don't want to hear you say anything else about it." Now here I is, 6 feet, 230 pounds, a mean 62-year-old black man, and this skinny little white lady thinks she can make me mine. Not even Big Mama talked to me like that. That was fixing to be a problem, a big problem. Finally, the day come for the retreat, and Miss Debbie drives down to the mission looking for me. I was doing my best to hide out, but some helpful fellas spotted me and told her where I was at. She convinced me to at least come on out to the car and see who all was going. I didn't want to be ugly to her, 'cause we was getting to be friends and all. So I walked on out in front of the mission. I looked in Miss Debbie's Land Cruiser, and sure enough, there was four other white ladies sitting inside. In my life, I had bad enough luck with just one white lady, and here was four, all smiling and waving at me. "Come on, Denver, we want you to go with us." Right about then, one of the street fellas sitting on the mission steps started sing-songing like a little girl. "Yeah, Denver, you go right on," and busted out laughing. Then his friend piped up and started in, singing, "Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home." And they both busted up. I didn't think it was funny, but I had to make up my mind. There was all them white ladies in the car trying to be so nice to me, and there was them fellas sitting on the steps singing me a funeral song. I guess I knowed I was taking my life in my hands when I got in that car, 'cause it was a cold day in January, but I was sweating like a hog in August.
Chapter 28. While I'd been getting to know Denver, my art business percolated profitably, with clients seeking out my partners and me instead of the other way around. We worked with an elite group of clients who were interested only in the finest works. Even so, in the fall of 1998, I received the kind of call of which art dealers' fantasies are made. The call came after Denver and I had begun making the rounds of museums. I had just dropped him off near the Mission when my cell phone rang. The man on the line headed a large Canadian real estate development firm that had purchased a 36-story bank building in downtown Fort Worth. Fortunately for the Canadians, the deal included Eagle, a 40-foot sculpture by the 20th-century master Alexander Calder, one of only 16 monumental stabile sculptures the artist executed in his lifetime. At that moment, Eagle was firmly nested 18 inches deep in the concrete plaza outside the bank building, a spot that dominated the heart of the city. The citizens of Fort Worth had long considered the master sculpture public domain, a symbol of the city's place in the world of art and culture. The new Canadian owners, however, weren't so sentimental. The man on the phone said they wanted me to sell it. My heart raced as I thought of the possibility of making this seven-figure deal, likely to be the biggest of my career at that time or ever, especially since a Calder sculpture of that category would almost certainly never be for sale again. At the same time, I realized that if I did sell it, I risked being run out of town. I knew that to be a fact because the prior owner, a bank in crisis, had asked me to explore a sale only a couple of years earlier, but had ultimately backed down, bowing to citizen pressure so formidable that even local museums had declined to buy the Calder and left it in the city instead. But the Canadians, the man on the phone said, wanted a deal that was clean, fast, and silent. And as it happened, I had a buyer. We developed a plan shrouded in secrecy that included code names, as well as The Phoenix, a Delaware corporation my partners and I set up just to handle this very special transaction. We hired two 18-wheel transport trucks, along with crews and drivers who would jackhammer and disassemble the 12-ton sculpture under cover of darkness. I joked that if word leaked, the workmen might need to wear body armor. But maybe I was only half joking. So great was the need for absolute secrecy that the plan included the proviso that the crews would not be told where they were taking Eagle until they crossed the Texas border into Oklahoma. We set the date for the move, April 10th. Months passed as my partners and I hammered out the details. Meanwhile, I worked on my relationship with Denver. In late December, I'd started trying to talk him into going to the mountain retreat with Debbie. But by January, I'd pretty much given up on that idea. Deborah and Mary Ellen were still going, but I wasn't there to see them off since the retreat coincided with the Palm Beach Art Fair. That's where I was when my cell phone rang, just as I was attempting to sell a Matisse drawing to a fancy couple wearing matching pink slacks. It was Deborah, calling to tell me that she'd convinced Denver to go to the retreat. Our son, Carson, by then 22 and aiming toward a career dealing in art, had joined me on the trip, so I excused myself and let him take over. In light of Denver's Jump Street speech, I couldn't believe he'd actually gotten in Deborah's car, or even more amazingly, that he had stayed at the retreat the whole weekend. The highlight, Deborah chattered over the phone, was the last day when Denver, urged on by all the white ladies, sang. Reluctantly, he sat down at the piano in the worship area and belted out a song he made up as he went. His audience gave him a standing ovation. "I wish you'd been there," Deborah said. "I wish I had, too." On the other hand, I thought, if I had been, maybe Denver and I would have been off fishing when God wanted Denver to be singing. On second thought, I said, I think everyone was exactly where we needed to be. I couldn't wait to hear Denver's take on the retreat. The horrors of hanging with white ladies and all that. But that Tuesday, when we went down to the mission, I learned that no one had seen him since Deborah had dropped him off on Sunday. And the next day, still no Denver. That night at home, Deborah and I had started to feel like a family member had gone missing when the phone rang. It was Denver, calling from a hospital. "I'm okay," he said, "but when I got home from the retreat, I was hurting so bad, I walked to the hospital and checked myself in." I dropped everything and took off. The Harris Hospital is a good 2 miles southwest of the mission. I sped there, making a quick stop at Whataburger to pick up Denver's favorite milkshake, vanilla. Inside Harris, I remembered the floor but forgot the room number, so I walked down the long hall, peeking into each room as I went. Finally, I saw his name, hand-printed on a card, slipped into a slot on a closed door. A pretty blonde nurse stood nearby, jotting notes on a chart. "Can I help you?" "Well, I just spent the last 10 minutes looking for my friend's room, but I guess I just found it," I said, nodding toward Denver's name card. "He won't be in there," she said, lowering her voice confidentially. "The man in there is black and homeless." I grinned. "Then I'm obviously in the right place." Embarrassed, she skirted off, probably hoping I wouldn't tell her boss. I pushed my way through the door. "Hey there, Denver. All those white ladies put you in the hospital?" Denver, by now able to laugh, told me about his long walk to the hospital through the hood. "Don't tell Miss Debbie, but out there at the religious resort, I just kept eating all that free food, but I just didn't feel right about using the man's bathroom, so I didn't go the whole time I was up there. So here I am trying to get unplugged." We both howled. When we finally settled down, he got serious. Miss Debbie knowed what she was doing, taking me up to that retreat. He didn't confide any details, and I didn't press. A couple of weeks later, when his innards were ready, I took Denver to the Mexican restaurant, where he had first learned to identify the parts of a combination plate. He ordered his usual, taco, enchilada, rice, and beans, but he pushed it all around on his plate, more interested in talking than eating. Miss Debbie knowed what she was doing, taking me out of the street environment I was in so I would have time to think about my life, he said. "You know, you got to get the devil out the house before you can clean it up. And that's what happened to me up in them woods. I had time to clear my head and shake loose some old demons and think about what God might have in mind for the last part of my life." Then Denver got quiet again. Finally, he parked his fork tines in his refrieds, wiped his hands on his napkin, and put it back in his lap. "Mr. Ron, I got something important to tell you. The work Miss Debbie is doing at the mission is very important. She is becoming precious to God." Denver's brow wrinkled and his head dropped. Then with that dark glower that always preceded his most serious pronouncement, he said something that still rings in my ears today. "When you is precious to God, you become important to Satan." Watch your back, Mr. Ryan. Something bad getting ready to happen to Miss Debbie. The thief comes in the night. Chapter 29. Certain days in life, you remember the headlines. November 22, 1963, JFK assassinated. Easy to remember since I had a front row seat. July 20, 1969, Neil Armstrong took one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind as Deborah and I, newly engaged, made out on the couch in my apartment at TCU. April 1st, 1999. I remember the headlines from that day less for the events themselves than for the fact that April Fool's Day was the fulcrum that flung our lives down a path we could not have foreseen. Per our usual coffee in the kitchen routine, it was the Bible for Deborah that morning, the Star Telegram for me. Albanian refugees were pouring out of Kosovo, the paper said. Former Catwoman Eartha Kitt was still lounge singing at age 72. Texas Governor George W. Bush had pulled in $6 million in less than a month for his likely presidential campaign. After coffee, Deborah took off for her exercise class, then to her annual physical. She was military about that yearly visit. She checked in, got the "You are in fantastic health for a woman half your age," report from the doctor, then made her appointments for the following year on her way out the door. Weddings, parties, and travel plans all were scheduled around that physical. I headed out for my office in Dallas, looking forward to a lunch date with our daughter, Reagan. She had been working for me in the gallery. With an art history degree from the University of Texas and a certificate of completion from Christie's Fine Arts course in New York City, it seemed like a natural fit. But she hated it. Even in high school, Reagan had felt more comfortable around the disadvantaged than the privileged. She often would whip up a batch of sandwiches, and we were mortified to find out later, take them alone to the bums living under the bridges in downtown Dallas. During the Christie's course, she discovered she did not enjoy the art business. The pampered clients, the self-involved dealers, the pretentious power lunches. But maybe it was just that way in New York City, she thought. So she kept mum, came home, and stuck it out at our Dallas gallery for a while. Carson, meanwhile, was a senior at TCU, and Deborah was enjoying having all her chicks back in the nest. But Reagan's discontent grew daily. So we met for lunch that day at Yamaguchi Sushi, and in a corner booth over raw tuna topped with jalapeno slices, got down to the serious business of charting another course for her life. As we discussed options, grad school, and ministry among them, my cell phone rang. It was Deborah. "Craig felt something in my abdomen," she said, her voice thin and strained. The doctor, a personal friend named Craig Dearden, wanted to do a sonogram in his office, then send her to the hospital for x-rays. "Would you come back to Fort Worth and meet me at All Saints?" "Absolutely," I said. "I'll be there in a half an hour. And don't worry, okay? You're the healthiest person I know." I hated to cut short lunch with Reagan, but we agreed to reschedule the next day, and I told her I'd call as soon as I talked with Craig. When I arrived at All Saints, I found Deborah in the radiology waiting room. Mary Ellen was already there. So was Alan, an All Saints physician and former chief of staff. I scooped Deborah into a long hug. Her shoulders felt tense, but she gradually relaxed. I pulled back and looked into her eyes. "You okay?" She nodded, trying on a weak smile. Deborah got x-rays, but also a CAT scan. When the films were ready, we sat in an examining room, lights dimmed, X-ray illuminator glowing. Another doctor, John Burke, clipped the first film to the illuminator. At first, the amorphous image, milky white on gray, meant nothing to me. "This is Deborah's liver," Dr. Burke explained, drawing an invisible circle around a shape on the screen. Then I saw them, shadows. Her liver was completely covered with them. As we stared at the film, several more doctors filtered into the room, their white coats and serious faces vaguely blue in the dim light. A couple of them experimented with sounding upbeat. "These spots are a little troubling, but it's nothing to worry about yet," said one. "It's possible they're birthmarks," said another. "I've seen that before." But none of them looked us in the eye. The word cancer floated through my mind like a poisonous gas, but I didn't dare utter it. "We've scheduled a colonoscopy for tomorrow morning," Craig said. "They would withhold judgment until then." At home that night, we settled into bed, and Deborah shared with me the story of Joshua and Caleb, two of 12 men that Moses sent to spy out the Promised Land and bring back a report for the children of Israel. We lay facing each other, heads on white-cased pillows. "When the spies came back, they brought good news and bad news," Deborah said, her voice lilting softly like a storyteller. "The good news was that the land did flow with milk and honey, just as God had promised. The bad news was that the land was inhabited by giants." "The Israelites wept with fear," she went on, "all except for Joshua and Caleb, who said, 'If the Lord is pleased with us, he will give us the land. Do not be afraid.'" Deborah fell silent for a few minutes, then raised her eyes to mine. "Ron, I'm afraid." I pulled her to me and held her. We prayed about the colonoscopy, that the Lord would be pleased with us, that the doctors would bring back a good report. Stars hung like ice in a black sky when we pulled into the All Saints parking lot the next morning. Word of Deborah's pending diagnosis had spread among our friends, and we were surprised and touched to find about 20 of them clustered in the day surgery waiting room, praying. As the doctors wheeled Deborah away and she made her pale face brave, we prayed for a good report. I posted myself outside the door of the endoscopy room, as close to Deborah as they'd let me get, and paced the cold tile floors. I alternated between prayer and mild panic, between the peace of God that surpasses all understanding and bubbling nausea. An eon ticked by, then an epoch. Sand through an hourglass, a grain at a time. Finally, through the square of wired safety glass, I saw nurses wheeling Deborah into recovery and rushed to join her. Through heavily lidded eyes, she looked up at me, her bottom lip protruding slightly in a way it did only when she was truly sad. She mouthed the word, "Cancer." Her lips attempting a half-smile to cushion the blow. Then tiny tears appeared in the corners of her eyes and spilled down her pale cheeks, and I remembered her words from the night before. "Giants in the Promised Land."
Chapter 30. It was Miss Mary Ellen that told me about Miss Debbie. She come down to the mission alone to lead that Bible study Sister Betty let him have, and when I seen Miss Debbie wasn't with her, I asked her where was she at. Miss Mary Ellen put her hand on my shoulder. "I have some bad news, Denver. Miss Debbie went to the doctor, and it's serious. She has cancer." When Miss Mary Ellen said cancer, I couldn't hardly believe it. Didn't look like a thing in the world was wrong with Miss Debbie.
Here she was, coming down to the mission 2 or 3 times every week, feeding down at the lot, leading a Bible study. Seemed so perfect in her health. The first thing I knowed was that God was gonna heal Miss Debbie. The second thing I knowed was that I was afraid. What if he didn't heal her? In my life, I had already lost most of the people that was important to me. Big Mama and Uncle James and Aunt Etha. Miss Debbie was the first person that loved me unconditionally in over 30 years. Here I let her get close, and sure enough, looked like maybe God was getting ready to take her too. I got scared my life was gonna be changed forever. Then I started worrying, how was everybody else at the mission gonna take it when they heard? I ain't gonna sugarcoat it. They took it pretty hard. There's a lot of folks come down to the mission and volunteer, but most of them was not faithful like Miss Debbie. But that wasn't all. It was the way she treated the homeless that made them accept her as their friend. She never asked them no questions like, how come you is in here? Where you been? How many times you been in jail? How come you done all them bad things in your life? She just loved them, no strings attached. That's the way she loved me, too. The word says, God don't give us credit for loving the folks we want to love anyway. No, he gives us credit for loving the unlovable. The perfect love of God don't come with no conditions. And that's the kind of love Miss Debbie showed the folks at the mission. After we heard about Miss Debbie, me and Chef Jim got to be pretty tight. We never had no special prayer group before, but every morning me and Chef Jim would meet up in the kitchen and pray for Miss Debbie and her family. And there was other folks praying too. You know, if you ain't poor, you might think it's the folks in them big old fine brick churches that's doing all the giving and the caring and the praying. I wish you could have seen all them little circles of homeless folks with their heads bowed and their eyes closed, whispering what was on their hearts. Seemed like they didn't have nothing to give, but they was giving what they had, taking the time to knock on God's front door and ask him to heal this woman that had loved them.
Chapter 31. Deborah's doctors scheduled another surgery for 3 days later. Deborah, Carson, Reagan, and I retreated to Rocky Top to pray and think things through as a family. Maybe retreated isn't the right word, at least not in my case, for the ranch became my war room. We would probably spend a year in this battle, I told Deborah, then celebrate our victory, maybe even with a parade like soldiers returning from war or the Apollo 13 astronauts rumbling safely back to Earth after a space flight that seemed doomed. On the road from here to there, we knew that pain, tears, and fear waited like assassins, but pain makes life fuller, richer. And I remembered what Denver's Aunt Etha told him. Good medicine always tastes bad. I was confident that the right medicine was out there, and it became my mission to find it. As of that day, supported by my partners, I basically hung an out-of-business sign on my Dallas gallery. It was only days before hired crews were to sweep into Fort Worth to remove the Calder sculpture in the most lucrative coup of my career. But my partners agreed to handle the final operation, and I asked them not to fill me in on the details. It meant nothing now. I was in the Army again, this time a field general in the War on Cancer. Our friends, Roy Jean and Payne Evans, joined us at Rocky Top, an investor, horseman, and the scion of a prominent Dallas family. Roy Jean had built his ranch house one bluff over from ours, overlooking the same crescent of the Brazos and the green valley beyond. We had spent nearly every weekend at the ranch with them for the past 8 years.
They hadn't planned to come down that weekend, but drove the 100 miles just to come and love on Deborah for a while and encourage her to fight hard. Roy Jean, as another friend once described him, is a little like John Wayne, a big, comforting presence who speaks slowly, softly, and uses few words, but always good ones. Pam is a cancer survivor, a woman of many words who uses them to heal, like salve on a wound. Conflicting emotions layered those days, Rocky Top. Our optimism and confident prayers for healing were real, but like rain falling from a sunny sky. Deborah and I sensed, without discussing it aloud, that her prospects for a long life were grim. A few years earlier, we had lost our friend John Trulson to colon cancer of the liver. After multiple rounds of debilitating chemotherapy, he died, withered to a shadow and racked with pain. Those memories were fresh on both our minds. "Ron, if the cancer is spread outside my colon and those spots we saw aren't birthmarks, I don't want to fight it," she told me on our second day at Rocky Top. "We don't have to make that decision now," I said. But in fact, the decision had already been made. This was the woman who feared nothing but rattlesnakes and yellow jackets, who had stared a dead marriage and another woman in the eye and fought to keep her man, who tamed Denver Moore, the meanest junkyard dog in one of the nastiest ghettos in Texas. She would fight. She just didn't know it yet. And yet, for all the courage I knew she had, she had shown this glimmer of fear. Oh, how I loved her then. Fiercely. The passion you feel down in your guts, where no one else can see and only you know its frightening force. I could remember that there were times in our nearly three decades of marriage that I had loved her less than at that moment, and guilt pierced my heart like a spike. Though she had always given unconditionally, I had often not been willing to do so in return. She has deserved better than she's gotten from me, I thought, and nearly drowned in a wave of regret, 30 years deep. Then I resolved to love her as she had never been loved before. On the day of the surgery, we drove to All Saints Hospital, unsure of our future, but with a full tank of faith. A team of surgeons, led by Dr. Paul Center, planned to remove most of her colon and any other cancer they found that they deemed safe to remove. During the 5-hour surgery, about 50 friends gathered in the waiting room. 5 hours after surgical technicians wheeled my wife away, Dr. Center returned, unsmiling and battle-weary. He asked to speak to me and the children alone. "I'll be honest with you," he said after we'd moved to a small office. "It's not good." The cancer had pushed outward from her colon, invading her entire abdominal cavity, wrapping itself around her liver like a shroud. "She needs more surgery," he said. I asked for no prognosis, no time left to live, as only God knows the number of our days. Still, God had apparently been busy with other matters. Our most passionate prayers had not triggered a good report after the colonoscopy. Our prayers for healing at Rocky Top had not beaten back the lethal invader doctors had discovered inside my wife. Wounded and nearly blind with fear, I clung to the scriptures. "Ask, and you shall receive. Pray without ceasing. I will do whatever you ask for in my name." Grimly, I shut out another verse, this one from the book of Job. "The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away." After the surgery, I sat shell-shocked beside Deborah's bed. Tubes bristled from her face and arms, probing her sleep, snaking back to boxes that blinked a maddening medical code I couldn't understand. My insides felt crushed, as though we'd been injured in some apocalyptic accident. Numb and silent, I waited for her to wake. I did not move my eyes from hers. I wondered what she might be feeling. I wondered if either of us would survive. That Deborah would get cancer made no more sense than a drive-by shooting. She was the most health-conscious person I had ever known. She didn't eat junk food or smoke. She stayed fit and took vitamins. There was no history of cancer in her family. Zero risk factors. What Denver had said 3 weeks earlier haunted me. Those precious to God become important to Satan. Watch your back, Mr. Ron. Something bad fixing to happen to Miss Debbie. Just before midnight, she stirred. I stood and leaned over her bed, my face pressed close to hers. Her eyes opened, drowsy with narcotics. Is it in my liver? Yes, I paused and looked down at her, trying vainly to drive sadness from my face. But there's still hope. She closed her eyes again, and the moment I had dreaded for hours passed quickly without a single tear. My own dry eyes didn't surprise me. I had never really learned how to cry. But now life had presented a reason to learn, and I yearned for a river of tears, a biblical flood. Maybe my broken heart would teach my eyes what to do. Chapter 32. After 4 days, Deborah's hospital room looked like a florist's shop. But when mountains of roses, daisy, and bluebonnets began spilling into the hallway, the hospital administrator decreed they would have to go. Deborah insisted we take them to the mission. We already had a little experience with this. Earlier that year, she had taken bouquets there to decorate the tables in the dining hall, but Don Schisler and Chef Jim nixed the idea, concerned that some parts of the arrangements, like the wires holding the flowers erect, could be used as weapons. Hard for us to imagine. But then, we were naive when it came to flower weapons. Anyway, thinking mission management might make an exception this time, Carson and I hauled 2 truckloads of concealed pistols down to East Lancaster Street, where we walked in the front door. An unusual sight struck me, 6 or 7 men holding hands in a circle. Tino, a bald-headed Telly Savalas look-alike, caught my eye. We're praying for Miss Debbie. We love her, and we want her back. Overwhelmed, Carson and I joined the circle and prayed with these men who seemed, on the outside, to have nothing to give but had been giving, without our knowing it, the most precious gift of all, compassion. Afterward, we scattered flowers everywhere, the chapel, the dining hall, the ladies' dorm, an explosion of color, brightening cinder block and institutional tile. It reminded me of that first day we pulled up to the mission, and Deborah had daydreamed about daisies and picket fences. We hadn't seen Denver since the cancer diagnosis, and I was concerned that he might be feeling he'd been caught and released. In the hallway to the kitchen, we ran into Chef Jim. I asked him if he'd seen Denver that day. "He's probably sleeping," he said. "Sleeping?" I blurted. "Lazy," I thought. It was already mid-afternoon. Jim raised an eyebrow. "You don't know?" "Know what?" "Well, when Denver heard about Miss Debbie, he told me she had a lot of friends that would be praying for her all day, but he figured she needed someone to pray all night, and he would be the one to do it." My eyes widened as he went on. "So he goes outside at midnight, sits down next to the dumpster, and prays for Miss Debbie and your family. When I get up and come down here at 3 a.m. to get breakfast going, he comes in for a cup of coffee, and we pray here in the kitchen for her till about 4. Then he goes back outside and prays till sunup. Ashamed, I realized again how deep grew the roots of my own prejudice, of my arrogant, snap judgments of the poor.
Chapter 33. I guess I could have prayed in my bed, but I felt like I was keeping watch, and I didn't want to fall asleep like Jesus' disciples in the garden. And I could have prayed in the chapel, but I didn't want nobody coming around breaking my concentration. I know wasn't nobody going to come around the dumpster, so that's why I kept watch over Miss Debbie every night, what they call a vigil. I sat on the ground with my back propped up against the brick wall of an old building where the dumpster was at and looked up into the dark sky and talked to God about her. I asked him a lot to heal her, and I also asked him why. Why have you afflicted this woman who has been nothing but a faithful servant to you? Someone who is doing what you said, visiting the sick, feeding the hungry, inviting the stranger in. How come you bring this heartache to her family and cut off the love she be giving to the homeless? It didn't make no sense to me. But after a while, God explained it. A lot of times when I was out there, I seen a shooting star burn across the black sky, bright one minute and gone the next. Every time I seen one, seemed like it was going to fall all the way to the ground, and I couldn't understand why I never could see where it went. After I seen a lot of them act that way, I felt like God was giving me a message about Miss Debbie. The word says God put every star in the heavens and even give every one of them a name. If one of them was going to fall out of the sky, that was up to him, too. Maybe we can't see where it's going to wind up, but he can. That's when I knew that even though it didn't make no sense to me, God had put Miss Debbie in my life like a bright star, and God knew where she was going to wind up. And I found out that sometimes we just have to accept the things we don't understand. So I just tried to accept that Miss Debbie was sick and kept on praying out there by the dumpster. I felt like it was the most important job I ever had, and I wasn't going to quit.
Chapter 34. Deborah's hospital stay lasted a week. 7 days after that, the rental house we'd been staying in sold, but our new home on the Trinity River wouldn't be ready for several more weeks. A month earlier, that might have thrown Deborah, but she was way past worrying about something as mundane as a roof over our heads. If she couldn't beat the cancer, there would be no need for a house here on Earth. Still, we needed one for the meantime, so the Davenports opened their home to us. For the next 2 months, 9 of us lived together. The 4 adults, the Davenports' 4 kids, and Deborah's sister, Daphne, who became her near-constant companion. Mary Ellen and Alan had been our best friends for 19 years, but while we lived with them, we grew even closer. So close, we even washed our underwear in the same load. Meanwhile, their home came to resemble the world headquarters for Meals on Wheels. Church friends brought home-cooked meals every day, sometimes for as many as 17 people. When Carson, Reagan, and all the kids' boyfriends and girlfriends were factored in, many who wanted to bring food never got to. The line was too long. Less than a month had passed since Dr. Dearden first found lumps in Deborah's abdomen, but already pain had become a formidable enemy. It raged like wildfire,
through her belly, forcing her out of bed at night to pace, sit upright, soak in a hot bath, anything to change her focus. It seemed surreal to us. How could the pain flare from being non-existent to a bonfire in so short a time? We asked Alan, who had treated cancer patients. He compared cancer to hornets. You can stand next to a hive, even get hornets all over you and not get stung, but poke a stick in the hive and stir it up, and the hornets can fly into a rage and kill you. The surgeries had seemed to stir the tumors in Deborah's abdomen into a venomous fury, but she hated taking pain medications. For one thing, she feared addiction. Also, she had dozens of visitors and loathed the idea of receiving them drugged up and slurring, and so sleep became an elusive dream as we battled the enemy of pain. 4 weeks after her first surgery, we drove to Baylor University Medical Center to see Dr. Robert Goldstein, a world-renowned liver specialist. After an MRI, we met with the doctor in his office. It was a space curiously absent of diplomas and other credentials, filled instead with pictures of the gray-haired, ponytailed doctor and his pretty wife posing on Harley Davidsons. Facing us across his desk, Dr. Goldstein wasted no words. "I'm sorry, the MRI results aren't good." Deborah and I sat next to each other in a pair of side chairs. "What do you mean?" she asked. He laid it on the line. "Most people in your condition live no more than a year." In the millisecond it took for his last few words to register in her brain, Deborah fainted. She actually fell out of her chair onto the floor. Dr. Goldstein dashed into the hall, waving his arms like an accident bystander trying to flag down help. I dropped to my knees and lifted her limp body so that her head lay in my lap. A nurse came in, the doctor close behind, and covered Deborah's face and arms with cool, damp cloths. Moments later, she came to, pale and shaking, and I helped her get back into her chair. Then I put one arm around her shoulders, and with my other held her hand. I gazed at Dr. Goldstein for a moment, knowing he was a walking repository of the latest information on colon cancer. There had to be options. "What's your recommendation?" I asked him. "Nothing," he said. Then he looked at Deborah. "The cancer's too extensive. If you were my wife, I would send you home and tell you to enjoy your family as best you can, and hope a cure can be found within the next few months." Deborah looked deeply into Dr. Goldstein's eyes. "Do you believe in God?" "I believe in medicine," he said. Accordingly, he ticked off treatment options, then shot them down like skeet. Chemotherapy wouldn't work. Liver resectioning, too many tumors on both lobes. Ablation, or burning the cancer off the liver, tumors too large. His words hit like hammer blows, crushing our hope. I could feel my heart pounding, breaking, our hands clasped tight. Deborah and I stood. "Thank you for your opinion, Dr. Goldstein," I said through lips that felt like wax. We walked out of his office and out to the car, where we sat, mute and paralyzed. Finally, Deborah spoke into the roaring silence. "Let's praise God," she said. "For what?" I thought, without saying it. "Let's forget what he said about only living 1 year, and let's just trust God," she told me. "Dr. Goldstein is just a doctor. We serve the living God. Who knows our number of days? I intend to fulfill each one of mine." Despite the hope-crushing meeting with Dr. Goldstein, Deborah and I weren't going down without a fight. Shortly after moving in with the Davenports, she commenced a grueling course of chemotherapies at a grim-looking oncology clinic in Fort Worth. The chemo lab was gray and dimly lit, with 20 blue recliners laid out on linoleum tile in two ranks of 10, usually full with cancer warriors, pale and gaunt. Deborah lay there, soldier-like, for 3 or 4 hours at a stretch, as poison dripped into her veins. She said the chemicals felt like heavy metal flowing into her body. She could taste iron and copper. No screens or dividers created private spaces for suffering. So, as I sat with her, talking softly, stroking her hair, people around us vomited into trays provided for the purpose. Sometimes Mary Ellen or other friends would come and sit with her, read to her. We usually didn't make it far from the clinic before Deborah was overcome with a wave of nausea or diarrhea. I'd pull the car over and help her through it. Apart from her pain, the indignity of being unable to control her body was tough going for a woman who had never looked tousled, even when she got out of bed in the morning. The medicine took her down quickly, slashing her weight to 100 pounds. Still, she was determined to eradicate the enemy and insisted on trying different kinds of chemo treatments, sometimes in the same week, hoping to incinerate the cancer with the medical equivalent of napalm. At home, whenever she could lift her head off the pillow, she slipped on her Reeboks and we would walk together. The kids and I couldn't get her to stop, even when she ran out of strong. Chapter 35. It was Deborah who first brought up the idea of getting Denver a driver's license. In the fall of 1998, she felt bad that her cancer, and how it consumed our time, was hampering Denver from being more a part of our lives. If he had a license, she reasoned, he could more freely join in the things we were doing, without being dependent on our hunting him down in the hood. When we broached the subject with Denver, he responded in typical fashion. "Let me think about it," he said. A few weeks later, we talked in a round over coffee at the mission. "I like the idea of being able to drive, Mr. Ron," he said, "but I got to tell you, I ain't exactly clean." "Clean? I got a record." It seemed Denver had done a little scouting down at the Department of Public Safety. When the clerk typed his name into the computer, up popped a list of problems. A disorderly charge in Louisiana, a few unpaid tickets related to his car motel business, and, this was the deal breaker, a citation for marijuana possession, bestowed on him in Baton Rouge during some years he spent riding the rails. With the pot charge on his record, there could be no driver's license. Denver wanted to clear his name, so we agreed he had to travel to Baton Rouge and subject himself to the laws of Napoleon. It is an odd fact of American history that some laws in the Bayou State haven't been rewritten since the little Corsican still owned the place. It was December 1998, and we picked a sorry night for a road trip. A freezing rain had shut down highways all over Texas, but Denver wanted his past behind him, so I drove him down to the Greyhound station. He figured there might be a few drunks on the bus, but fewer than at the mission, which was always packed to the rafters during lousy weather. Denver wagered that a couple of $100 in the hand of the right Louisiana lawman might fix his legal problem. "That's just the way it is down there," he said, so I gave him $200 to pay the fine. After a long, slippery trip on the Greyhound, "That dog slid like a hog on ice," Denver told me later. He rolled into Baton